Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Hour 2 of Afternoons with Bill Arnold. I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in this week for Bill, who's taking time away. Appreciated the conversation last hour. I don't know if you had a chance to hear it with Dr. Larry Crabb. Rebecca, he is just so insightful, warm, rich, deep. You kind of want to hang on every word, don't you?
I do. Yeah. I thought that was just me.
Oh, no. That's very good.
I think it is the voice of experience without judgment. Hmm. And there's something so sincere and vulnerable about that. You can tell when somebody knows something versus when they've been through something. Yeah. And the application of that wisdom that comes through life and tough experiences. And he certainly had some of those. So I love learning from him.
You want to listen for that, you can go to the Afternoon Show page at myfaithradio.com and hear that interview podcast. We've got some great conversations coming up this hour. Rob Bluey making a regular appearance as part of the Afternoon Show regularly. He'll join us in a few minutes from the Daily Signal, and we'll kind of do a round the horn on some of the news of the day. Second half of this hour, looking forward to talking with Abdu Murray. He's an author and apologist with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. He's got quite a story, and we'll have him share a little bit about that as well. Speaking of not the judgment, I don't know, I probably don't qualify there because I'm not really into a pumpkin spice latte. But it's a sure sign of spring. Starbucks starts to serve it today. You feeling warmed and fall-like?
Appropriately knitwear clothes, getting out the sweaters sure. And the pumpkin spice. Sure, yeah, I'll own that.
Okay, all right. This year, Starbucks celebrates the 15th birthday of the drink. That's become a big favorite. And the customers will be able to choose from more than a half a dozen pumpkin spice latte flavored items, including pumpkin spice cookie straws, which I'd probably just go for that, skip the coffee, and pumpkin spice flavored ground coffee cake pods, so cake cup pods. So there you go. Beyond that, no, don't have much to comment, so not a coffee drinker, but I do have my hot water here, which is...
That's half a coffee.
It's a little lame, I know, but it does feel good in the throat, and it feels good to be able to talk news with someone who's got really a fresh perspective, and Rob Bluey brings that to us, and we're looking forward to connecting with him coming up in just a few minutes here as he joins us from the Daily Signal. So we'll talk, John McCain, we'll talk... politics and a variety of things, maybe get into some things about what it means to be a statesman and more. All that's ahead as we continue on the Afternoon Show here. I'm Neil Stavem sitting in. Thanks for tuning in.
Have you ever wished you could listen to your favorite radio program when you wanted to? That way you'd never miss a program you really wanted to hear simply because your program came on when you had an appointment. You were at work, or something urgent came up. And for those really busy days, you could listen early in the morning or late at night when things were calmer, and you could take the time to reflect and meditate on what you heard. Well, you can listen to your favorite programs whenever you want. Download the Faith Radio app by searching Faith Radio in the Apple Store or Google Play Store to gain instant access to Faith Radio programs and previous shows. It really is that simple. Search and subscribe to your favorite program and listen anytime. Download the Faith Radio app today and don't miss a thing. Once again, go to iTunes or Google Play on your mobile device and search for Faith Radio to download the free Faith Radio app and start listening today.
Well, thanks so much for tuning in this afternoon. I'm Neil Stavem, again, sitting in for Bill Arnold, and one of the regular contributors on the Afternoon Show is Rob Bluey. Rob is editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal, part of the Heritage Foundation. I've always appreciated Rob's part on the insight he adds for us here in Faith Radio. Rob, good to have you on this afternoon.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
You know, the lots of conversation, of course, these past few days about the life and legacy of John McCain, and I'd love to just give you a chance to weigh in on that, some observations as you reflect on his life and legacy.
Well, I feel pretty fortunate to have had the opportunity to see John McCain up close and personal as a reporter on Capitol Hill earlier in my career when I was you know, doing that on a day-to-day basis. He was somebody that you could always count on to give you a witty quote, be accessible and available to talk. I think that's one of the reasons that many Americans came to admire him, because he was somebody who, really had a breadth of knowledge on a range of issues, both domestic and foreign policy, and he was always willing, as his famous bus had it emblazoned, to give you straight talk. He would, not engage in any of the political speak. He told it straight like it was, and so that's one of the things that I think John McCain will be remembered for. But of course, in many respects, I mean, people look back at his capture by the Vietnamese and serving as a POW, somebody who went on in the U.S. House of Representatives to carry on conservative principles, and somebody who obviously people disagreed with. You may not have agreed with John McCain's position on the war in Iraq or on earmarks and spending issues in Congress, or even immigration, which was an issue that he took on later in his career. But I think one of the things that we all have came to admire about him was that he was somebody who, when he believed in something, he stood for it and made sure that he gave his best to try to accomplish it.
It was kind of an interesting, I guess, balance, wasn't it? I mean, he worked across the aisle, maybe more cooperatively than what we certainly see today, and yet he certainly had strong convictions and wasn't disagreed with his party more than maybe the opposition sometimes.
Oh, that's certainly true. Well, I was a college student in 2000 when John McCain was running for president against George W. Bush, and I was definitely a McCain fan at the time. And I think that independent streak and his willingness to buck the party line were certain attributes that the American people liked. I mean, certainly he was a challenge for Republicans at times. Campaign finance reform being another issue where he teamed up with Russ Feingold, a liberal Democrat, and pushed an issue that many Republicans didn't like, including the current majority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell. But at the same time, you had to respect him because, like I said before, when he believed in something, he was a true champion for it. And he recently spoke at the Heritage Foundation just last year, and I remember one of the opening lines was his friends and foes at the Heritage Foundation, because there were a number of issues like defense spending and military issues where we agreed with him, and then there were some issues where we didn't, but that didn't stop him from coming to speak before us, and that didn't certainly harm the friendships that he developed across the aisle in either case.
These words like maybe patriot and statesman, and I'm just thinking, how do we define those today? Someone who's a patriot, what does that mean? And maybe what does a statesman mean as well?
Well, I think that those are words that you're absolutely right in today's world, in which, you know, we seem like we're almost on a weekly basis talking about a lack of civility in our culture and politics in particular. Those words, do bring to mind somebody like John McCain, I think, for a number of reasons. First of all, as you said earlier, he was somebody who was able to go across party lines to get things done. And I think that, that's what people often think of a statesman. They think of people like Ronald Reagan, who, despite his differences with Tip O'Neill, at the end of the day could still sit down and enjoy a beer together and, have casual conversation and hopefully be friends beyond their political differences. In terms of being a patriot, you know, John McCain really does fit that definition, because he is somebody who served our country in war. He comes from a long family history of great fighters, somebody whose father was, highly decorated in the military. And McCain, in fact, when he was in that POW camp, he had the opportunity to be released because of the status of his father. And McCain chose to stay and said, "I'm not going to be released until you release every other prisoner of war." And I think that's what you think of when you think of a patriot, somebody who puts it all in the line for his country, and certainly John McCain did.
And I guess, thank the statesman, thinking about what the greater good of the country, as opposed to re-election, which, and you wonder, can the system kind of bring that back, in light of the deep disagreements that seem to be getting deeper, perhaps, right? And obviously the president probably isn't helping, but the opposition is sort of taking it on as a full-time challenge to try and be as difficult as possible.
Well, I definitely think that that's true. I mean, we're in a situation right now where our politics are at a very contentious point. But you know, as somebody who has recently seen the musical Hamilton, which is playing here in Washington D.C., and I know is coming to Minneapolis soon, you know, it's it reminds you of how our country throughout the decades and centuries has always been, in many cases, you know, fraught with these types of disputes. I mean, here you had a sitting vice president shooting Alexander Hamilton in a duel. Unfortunately, we haven't we don't have to worry about things like that happening today. We're squabbling over 140 character tweets and other things like that that the president says. And sometimes I think we all need to take a step back and say, how can we as individuals rise above some of the rhetoric and some of the tension that might be in place and try to forge those relationships? That's why I'm so positive about some of the things that happen at the local and state level. Yes, there's a lot of fighting here in Washington, D.C., but there are a lot of good things happening in state capitals and in local communities where people are coming together to get things done.
Is there a step, maybe a first step, that we can take to rise above, as you said, that, you know, some of the contentiousness?
Well, I think, I'd say one of the first steps, it starts at home, you know, especially if you have children, you know, teaching them values and principles to do this. I know that's something that's really important in our household, and it's something that we you know, take seriously at the Heritage Foundation, how we behave at Heritage and the type of, you know, behavior we exhibit on social media or in our coverage on the Daily Signal, I think hopefully serves as a role model for others, and they aspire to you know, do the same. And you're right, you know, there are many people who don't abide by that. But I think that, you know, as Christians, you know, it's one of those things that we just need to set our mind to and try to aspire to be better, and hopefully that will have a positive and lasting effect on other individuals.
The well-behaved Rob Louie with us today. He's editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal, and we're going to take just a quick break and come back and talk more. He mentioned that, you know, there's a lot of good news to talk about. We're going to talk about a good news story or two, as well as a few of the other stories in the news as we have the opportunity to talk with Rob here on the afternoon show. I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in for Bill Arnold. Thanks for tuning in to the afternoon show with Bill Arnold. I'm Neil Stavem, and talking today with Rob Louie, Rob, editor-in-chief from the Daily Signal, part of the Heritage Foundation, keeping us up to date on some of what's going on in the news, giving us a perspective. And, you know, before we could talk about, you know, NAFTA and electoral college systems and all those things and Google. But maybe before we do that, Rob, I know that your team has been gathering some good news stories recently. Why don't we is there one that maybe comes to mind that you could share, and kind of why are you pursuing that angle?
Well, there certainly is one, and it goes back to something that happened a year ago, which your listeners will certainly remember, and that is, you know, the historic flooding that took place in the wake of Hurricane Harvey in Texas. And there's an individual there in that community in Houston who goes by the name of Mattress Mac, and he is quite a legendary character. He's, you know, quite active in the community, and he really stepped up last year in a big way to help some of the people who were victims of some of the things that took place there in that community. So he's the co-founder of a business called Gallery Furniture, and he opened his stores to help those who were displaced. He donated a lot of furniture and money to help those in need. The Houston Astros, who won the World Series, even gave him a World Series ring. So, you know, a year later, he's still, you know, having an impact. And the reason I'm highlighting this story for you and your listeners is because I think it goes to show what individuals in their community can do in a time of need, and they don't have to always be so reliant on the government. It seems like every time one of these national disasters happens, you know, a hurricane or something of this nature, we always look to Washington and we look to what our government institutions need to do. That's certainly a piece of it, but on a local level and a civil society level, it's individuals like Mattress Mac who I think are really making a positive difference.
Is it scalable? You know, can I mean, it's one thing to have, you know, one guy, and of course, remember, you know, hearing the stories about this gentleman and the powerful impact he had. But so, you know, is it just individuals here and there, or can this actually sort of multiply out if we change the way we operate?
Well, I think that it could, certainly. I mean, I think that it probably happens on a daily basis in many communities. We just don't know about it because these things happen, you know, behind the scenes, and people, you know, are humble, and we're just news organizations. Let's face it, most news organizations, unlike yours and unlike ours, aren't highlighting good news. And I think if we continue to do that and stress some of the things, then yeah, probably it is scalable. But I think what you know, another thing that's a big factor in all of this is there are things that, yes, at a national level, this goes back to our conversation about John McCain, there are things that could be happening at a national level if we have the leadership here in Washington who's committed to doing that. And I think that's one of the things that Americans are frustrated about with the U.S. Congress. You have people who come to Washington with big, bold ideas, with solutions that they campaign on, and then they fail to deliver. And then it resorts to finger-pointing and name-calling and other things that the American people, I think, are just fed up with. So that's one of the reasons I said before I'm so encouraged by some things that are happening at the local level. But we need to bring that to Washington, and hopefully then we can scale it and have a positive impact.
Sure. You know, we're hearing a lot more about just getting the news out. Obviously, the Daily Signal is one of the ways that people can find out what's going on across the globe. It's really in D.C. But, you know, Google been under attack a bit about suppressing good news and conservative voices. What's your assessment of that?
Well, President Trump has accused Google of you know, manipulating the results, using its algorithm to favor liberal media outlets. You know, this is a concern that we've heard not just in the context of Google, but also Facebook and its algorithm. So it's real. I mean, we've seen firsthand some of the challenges at the Daily Signal that we face, and I think a lot of news organizations have. Though I don't think that necessarily there's any publisher in America or broadcaster who hasn't experienced some challenges with algorithms from these tech companies. The question is whether or not they're disproportionately affecting conservatives over some other sites. And that's certainly what the president was alleging. Google and Facebook have routinely denied that they're engaging in such behavior. But I think this is why it's so important for your listeners and our readers at the Daily Signal to get their news and information from sources directly. I mean, you cannot rely on Snapchat and Instagram and Facebook and Twitter to deliver all your news. This is why I still subscribe to a print newspaper. I mean, I have a lot of people who laugh at the notion. But to get magazines, to get newspapers, to get, you know, a lot of different information, and don't just rely on a conservative site or a liberal site, you know, make sure you are trying to get a sense of all of it, because then you'll be a more well-rounded person and you'll get news and information, and it'll take some of the power out of the hands of the Googles and the Facebooks of the world where they're not controlling everything because you are consuming it directly. And that's why I'll put a plug in for the Daily Signal. That's why your listeners can sign up for our daily email, which is one of the primary reasons we created it, because we wanted to go around these social networks and other tech companies and deliver it right to your inbox directly from us. So go to dailysignal.com and sign up today.
The paper doesn't land quite as hard as it used to, though, on the step in the morning. I don't know. You probably noticed that,
true.
Right? Wow. Anyway, well, I'm a man of my own heart, reading the paper every day. A couple of other news items we want to touch on here before our time is gone. The president's crafting some new trade agreements with Mexico, as say Canada can join in. That's been kind of an ongoing conversation for him. It looks like we're taking another step.
Yes, it certainly is. It's an encouraging step because obviously those of us who believe in the free market and do believe in the power of trade have had some concerns with this White House and some of the actions that it's taken, particularly against China, and some of the things we've heard about Mexico. So the fact that the president has come to the table with Mexico is encouraging. I think the devil's going to be in the details, though, because we have to pay attention to what exactly the policies are. We certainly should encourage Canada to be part of this agreement. NAFTA has been a powerful driver of the economic success story in the United States. And I think to subtract Canada from that would be a mistake. We need to lower the barriers, not increase them, and hopefully get rid of tariffs. And so that's, I think, what we're looking for out of this president. And as the details emerge over the course of this week, we remain hopefully optimistic that that will happen.
One of the other stories you were talking about and continues to come up is about the Electoral College system that, you know, we just need to swap that out for a popular vote. That push continues, doesn't it?
It certainly does. You've had a couple of instances this year where Arizona and Maine failed to get the required number of signatures for it to appear on November's ballot. But the Connecticut legislature did vote this year to join the national popular vote, which puts the plan just 98 again, Electoral College votes shy of becoming a reality. So basically what this means is that states would agree to award their electors, because we remember when we elect a president, it's state by state based on their Electoral College votes. So these states that have joined the compact would award their electors to the candidate who wins the popular vote, even if the candidate loses that state. So in the case of Connecticut, say the state voted for Hillary Clinton, but Trump won the popular vote, which didn't happen, but those electors would have to go to Trump. So it changes things on a quite dramatic scale. There's a lot of skepticism among conservatives for this reason, and we are keeping a close eye on it because, as we just talked about, it is getting closer to becoming a reality.
We've got just a minute left. One of the stories that we've been watching is in Florida, the shooting in Jacksonville, and one of the officials there suggested that, you know, this is not just a gun problem.
Well, right. I mean, there are a number of factors that come into play. I mean, we're still learning some of the information about what transpired there with the individual who carried out this terrible attack. And, you know, whether mental health was a factor, you know, there are a number of things that we've done both at the Heritage Foundation and tried to call attention to at the Daily Signal in the wake of some of the school shootings earlier this year to point out that even if you were to ban guns, it wouldn't stop some of the problems that we're seeing in our society. And there are some real positive steps that I think many people took after the Parkland tragedy and the Santa Fe, Texas tragedy. And, you know, the one thing that I think that is encouraging is that it's brought attention to some of the issues that are associated with individuals who might be in this position. And I think that this is another area where people can serve as role models in church, in school, in their workplace, to hopefully set a positive example and reach out to those in need and help them if they are facing depression and other issues.
We are finding more and more the issue of mental illness coming into the foreground time and time again. So it's one that we're going to have to continue to address and find some new ways to be more effective. And certainly our faith should play a part of it. Rob, we always appreciate the opportunity to do kind of a round the horn conversation about some of the issues in the news. I always appreciate the opportunity to connect with you.
Absolutely. It's great to talk to you again.
But just a moment away, we'll take a break and then bring in Abdu Murray. Abdu works with Rabbi Zacharias International Ministry. He's got quite a story. You're going to look forward to hearing his story, and we'll talk a little bit about his latest book and get to some thoughts about saving truth, finding meaning and clarity in a post-truth world. All that and more coming up here on The Afternoon Show. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning into Faith Radio here on this Tuesday afternoon, 28th of August. This is the anniversary of the significant event. 1963 it was. Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech at a civil rights rally in Washington, D.C. You've seen the pictures. Hopefully you've heard the address. Now, if it was media coverage today, we'd only get that little clip. The I Have a Dream, wouldn't hear any of the rest of it, but it was a powerful message. And I encourage you to maybe just look it up online and give a listen today. Now, there have been moments where there's been significant change in attitude, behavior, rallying cries, if you will. We're living in a time where we're looking for those moments when we can find clarity in a post-truth world. That's the subtitle of Abdu Murray's latest book, Saving Truth. We're going to talk with Abdu and hear a bit about his fascinating story in the moments ahead. He is the North American director with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. And if you're a regular listener to Faith Radio, you know that Ravi is kind of a cornerstone program on each afternoon on our way home. So you listen to Abdu now and Ravi here in about an hour, and we'll have a good conversation in just a minute.
So what's the Chinese word for oops? For the Colson Center, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. After decades of a one-child policy, which led to forced abortions and 30 million missing girls, the Chinese government is reversing course. 3 years ago, it raised the limit to 2 children, and now, the New York Times reports, the Communist Party is actually encouraging citizens to have more children. But it's not going well. The Chinese are used to only having 1 or 2 children, which isn't enough to maintain the population or stave off economic turmoil. As one economic commentator predicted, China will grow old before it grows rich. Chinese officials will keep trying. Some provinces are considering incentives like tax breaks and housing subsidies, similar to those tried but largely unsuccessful in Europe. China's suffering the consequences of years of government overreach and interference with families due to misplaced population panic. Lifting the restrictions is a good start, but you can't replace millions of missing children overnight. I'm John Stone Street.
It's a pleasure for me to sit in for Bill Arnold this afternoon and talk with the great guests that come across this program on a regular basis. One of those honored to talk to is Abdu Murray, who's a North American director with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, author of several books, including Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. And we're going to learn about his journey. He was, for most of his life, a proud Muslim, studied the Quran and Islam, and then began a search that led to faith in Christ. And he speaks on campuses. In fact, maybe your kids are heading back to a university campus where Abdu has perhaps done some campus forums with Ravi Zacharias and others, and we'll find out what that's like. Abdu, welcome to Faith Radio. Good to have you back on.
It's great to be on, Neil. Thanks for having me. I love being on the show.
You know, want to just have you maybe tell a bit about your story again, because it was a pretty... I guess maybe long by our standards, maybe not. But I mean, were you a serious seeker, or in terms of Christianity, or just world religions? Is that what prompted your interest in faith?
Actually, it started off as me being a little bit on the close-minded side. Believe it or not, I had this, which is not a close-minded view, that certain things are true, and my perspective doesn't matter. Hmm. In other words, things are true even if people don't believe them, or if they do. And so I thought Islam was true, and I was engaging with Christians. Actually, you know, it was Christian because they were sort of low hanging fruit in my area where I grew up. And but I was an equal opportunity sort of faith knocker outer of her. There was, you know, there were atheists, Jews, Hindus, you know, Buddhists here or there. Not very many, but there were a couple. But for the most part, it was Christians I was talking to about why I thought they were wrong and why Islam was right. And one of the reasons why I thought Christianity was wrong was because I had this strong sense of if God exists, then he must be the greatest possible being, which is why Muslims say the phrase Allahu Akbar. It literally means God is greater. And so God's greatness is the single most important idea in Islam. And I thought Christianity actually insulted God's greatness. So I thought ideas like the Trinity and the incarnation of God in Christ and the cross were all insulting ideas. And so I made it my mission to sort of debunk those ideas for Christians. Now, I didn't do it, you know, in a mean or combative way. I would just engage in casual conversation. And over time, issues of God would come up, and I would begin to tell Christians why they were wrong and I was right. But a funny thing happened on the way to the mosque, as it were. I met some Christians who actually knew what they were talking about. Hmm. Now, unfortunately, at that time, there were a few, a blessed few, but they were still few. But they got me thinking about Christianity, and I began to look at things not because I had an open mind towards whether they were true or not. At first, it was just I wanted to make sure that I understood Christianity so I could debunk it. I didn't want to debunk the fake thing. I wanted to debunk the real thing. And along the way, as I began to encounter Christians who not only could answer my objections, but had a few objections of their own, I began to see this isn't so stupid after all. And that actually made me uncomfortable.
because oftentimes, and I say this quite often when I give my testimony or I talk about any worldview, whether it's atheism or Eastern religions or Islam or whatever, whenever you're faced with a contrary worldview and that worldview starts to seem credible, that becomes incredibly uncomfortable because what we want is not truth. What we want is comfort as human beings. We want to be validated. That's why we all have confirmation bias. We look at evidence in a way that confirms our own views, even if that evidence is contrary to our view. But I began to see the gospel was not only contradicting my worldview as a Muslim, but it was also credible. So it was a contradictory, competing, and credible worldview, and that became extremely uncomfortable for me because I didn't want to change who I was. I liked being who I was. I lived a good life, and I didn't smoke, drink, do drugs. I didn't have sex before marriage kind of a thing, none of that stuff. I was a good Muslim. I liked being Muslim. It was part of who I was. And the gospel was beckoning me to die to all that and to embrace Christ as Lord, and I just didn't want to do it. So as the evidence began to mount, my discomfort began to grow until I saw something, and it was this credibility, not just of the gospel in general, but of the specific points that I thought were the worst points. I thought the Trinity was silly. I thought the incarnation was wrong and insulting. I thought the cross was the ultimate humiliation for God. Why would I believe in a God like that? But then I began to see that the Trinity, the incarnation, and the cross are not things that insult God's greatness, but the very things that demonstrate God's greatness.
Powerful story. A good reminder for us, too, and maybe we'll talk about it in a bit. How do we become Christians who know what they're talking about? And that's what you've kind of given your life to here for many years, serving with Ravi. I'm curious, you were talking about your experience in Islam. I think what just last week or so, it was emphasis on the Hajj, making the pilgrimage to Mecca. Have you ever, was that something that you felt called to do, or what is that it's a requirement, yeah. I guess one of the five requirements, isn't it?
Yeah, there's actually two versions of the Hajj. There's the main Hajj, and then there's a smaller non-compulsory version. There's an optional one, but there's a compulsory one. And what we just experienced was a holiday called Adha, which is Eid al-Adha is a holiday where Muslims commemorate the attempted sacrifice by Abraham of his eldest son. That story actually is in the Quran, where Abraham takes his son up a mountain. They think it's Ishmael. The Bible says it's Isaac. But they do, in fact, celebrate that Abraham was willing to obey God and sacrifice his son. But in the story in the Quran, the God stops Abraham from killing his son and instead provides what the Quran says, a momentous sacrifice, or God ransomed his son with a momentous sacrifice, and there's a ram caught in a thicket or some kind of an animal. So Muslims actually do a pilgrimage, and they will commemorate this by slaughtering an animal in order to sort of commemorate what Abraham did, which, by the way, is incidentally, is a great bridge-building point for Christians and Muslims, because we share that story in common. And the question we always have to ask Muslims is, why did God ransom Abraham's son? Why was a ransom provided at all? It was merely a test of faith to see if Abraham would do it. Why provide the ransom? Why even call it a ransom, as the Quran does? And that would get us to a great discussion of the fact that God provides a ransom not just for Abraham's son, but for all of us. It was a foreshadowing of what was to come. But that's an aside and a little point of contact we can have with our Muslim friends. As a Muslim, I did feel called to want to do the Hajj. I converted to Christianity, and I began my journey, actually, and had my feelings about the credibility of the gospel in my 20s. I became a Christian at age 27, and so never really had either the financial means or the opportunity to actually go. At that particular moment, when I converted, I didn't go, but it was something that I was called to do, and many people I love and know have gone on the Hajj.
You know, say more about those opportunities for building bridges. Yes, I mean, we certainly don't have to argue about whose son it was, what son it was, Abraham. But to talk about that sacrificial, lamb or ram, are there other bridge building opportunities that you've found that we could easily take on as a means of conversation?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, my second book, Grand Central Question, tries to do this, something like this, between atheism, Hinduism, and Buddhism, and Eastern religions, and Islam, and takes each one of those and says, how do we find common ground upon which to talk? Now, I used already the analogy of bridge building, but I want to be careful because oftentimes I think that when you use bridge building, we refer to two-way streets, like, you know, because conversion runs one way. But so I often like to use the word platform. We find a common platform upon which we can stand, and we look at the various pools we can jump off into. Some pools have no water. Only one pool has all the water, so we got to figure out which one that is. But I think the way to do that with Muslims, for example, is that foundational issue of God's greatness, like I mentioned before. Muslims believe in God's greatness, and so do Christians. We believe that God's greatness is unsearchable, to quote Psalm 145. So I think this is a common platform, so we can say we both believe God is great, but which worldview actually justifies that greatness? So one common area I think that we have where we can begin to discuss is the idea that God is eternal, and he is uncreated, and also he's relational. So he's eternal, uncreated, and relational. And Muslims believe that, and so do Christians. But the problem is this. Muslims believe in a God who is Unitarian. He is one in his nature and one in his person. But if he's uncreated and he's relational and everything else was created, then when God was alone, he was incapable of being relational. There was no way for him to be relational. He would need to create something else to be who he is. The Trinity actually solves that issue because the Trinity teaches us that God isn't just one in his nature and one in his person. He is one in his nature. There is one being who shares three consciousnesses or three minds, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, each one loving the other from eternity. The uncreated being exists in a state of uncreated love, always an uncreated relationship. So he never needs to create anything to be relational. He always has a relationship within himself. And if he doesn't need anything, then he is truly great. And that's what we can share with our Muslim friends. That's but one example of the many.
Good word from Abdu Murray, talking about one of his books, Grand Central Question, and looking for some platforms for which to stand and to begin conversation with as we look to share the reality of who Jesus is and the reality of God's greatness. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about Abdu's work on campuses across the country, around the globe, actually. He is the North American Director with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, and has, you know, just been recently doing some campus forums. I'm interested in finding out what it's like on campus today, and are the questions the same as they were maybe, 10 years ago? We'll hear more from Abdu Murray in just a moment. Seven past the hour. It's the afternoon show. Bill Arnold, I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in, talking with Abdu Murray today from Ravi Zacharias International Ministries and author of several books, including his latest, Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. I know, Abdu, you were recently doing another campus forum. I'm interested in kind of what happens at an event like that, and is your goal to bring about the discomfort, as you talked about in your own journey, that uncomfortableness once you begin to hear more about a different worldview.
Yeah, and that is part of it. It's to make essentially the gospel credible, and while it's discomforting, and it's supposed to be, not overtly so, or not overly so, I should say. I think one of the things about apologetics people often say is that what are you so sorry about when you're being apologetic? Obviously, that's not the connotation. But I think the way some folks have done apologetics is they've engaged in the art of making somebody sorry they asked. Because we just sort of hit them over the head with all these facts and figures and make them lose an argument. The goal of RZIM is helping the thinker believe and the believer think. And what we want to do, essentially, our strategy is, sort of, you can follow it with what Blaise Pascal actually says. He says, men despise religion because they fear that it may be true. The cure for this is to show that religion is not contrary to reason, but worthy of reverence, respect. Next, make it attractive. Make good people wish it were true, and then show them that it is. That's a hard thing to do, because oftentimes when you go to a college campus, they don't want it to be true. They want it to be false. They want a caricature. of Christianity. They want to sort of blend either conservatism or republicanism or whatever it might be with evangelicalism. And there's all this baggage and trapping that goes alongside of it. And we're there to present the mere gospel, the straight-up gospel. And the trappings that go around it, you can work out eventually, but we're there to provide it with the gospel itself and try to make it as attractive as possible without compromising the message. And what we found is when you give a short talk to stimulate questions on some of the biggest topics I think that are facing young people, they're ready to engage. And I'm actually quite hopeful. Though it is a post-truth world that elevates feelings and preferences over facts and truth, given the number of people, the sheer thousands sometimes, who come to these open forums and line up and skeptics ask their questions, I'm actually quite hopeful because they're not just out to get you. They're not giving you zingers. They're asking hard questions, but they stick around and they want the answers. And judging by the conversations we have after and the emails and the phone calls we have after with these very same students and the number of them who are coming to Christ, I'm extremely hopeful.
So do you start with feelings and preferences, or maybe what does post-truth look like for apologetics today?
Yeah, and that's a great question because you have to at some point address the fact that people have desire for what they want to be true, or if they want to ignore truth because of what they desire. And that's always a tough thing because the questions are, in fact, changing in many ways. You know, 10, 12 years ago, this is how fast the culture changes. You know, the worldview that I inherited, or the cultural worldview I inherited when I graduated high school quite some time ago, is very different from the worldview my son will inherit when he graduates high school in just 4 years. What's interesting is that the worldview of the culture that my youngest daughter will inherit 4 years after my son will actually be different than the one he inherited. That's how fast things change. And so the questions become different. You know, it used to be the case that when you went to a college campus, they would ask you about science and faith issues almost exclusively, or doesn't the Bible have contradictions, or, you know, these kind of things, or, you know, can you reconcile for me how I don't see the resurrection really happening and all these various things, miracle claims. They would ask more fact-based questions. Now, I won't say it's more feelings-based, but it is more meaning-based. They ask meaning questions. And the fact questions are there, but they try to lodge them in terms of their meaning issues. And I think we're in a culture that desperately wants meaning and tries to foist meaning upon us through our feelings as opposed to truth. And we need to bridge the truth and fact, the truth and feeling gap. We need to bridge that gap, and that's what we try to do.
Talk about it as a cultural confusion, and there certainly seems to be a great deal of confusion, across the globe or across the whole spectrum.
Yeah. Well, that's why I wrote the book, actually, Saving Truth, was because I began to notice something, is that confusion started to become a virtue and clarity started to become a sin. When you think about it, if you're confused sexually and you admit it out loud, you're a hero. If you're confused morally, there are no moral boundaries and everything is sort of fluid, you're considered progressive. And if you're confused religiously, you know, all paths lead to God, so to speak, and no one has a lock on truth, well, you're considered tolerant. So you're heroic, you're progressive, and you're tolerant if you have these confused views. But if you're clear, you know, on sexual mores or sexual boundaries or even gender issues, you're considered a bigot. If you're clear on moral strictures, that there are certain objective moral values, and morality is not a progressive, evolving thing, but it's actually based on an unchanging, timeless creator, well, that's considered regressive. And if you're clear that there is only one way to God, well, that's considered intolerant. So if you're confused, you're a hero, you're progressive, and you're tolerant. If you're clear, you're a bigot, regressive, and intolerant. And that's what you find yourself facing all the time. And you have to sort of dispel these things carefully and deftly, but yet you do have to do it. And oftentimes it is these preconceived notions of Christianity that get in the way of the truth of the gospel. And our job, I think, is to dispel that. And that's why I wrote the book.
Well, maybe you can just give us a little foretaste or a little snippet, because as you said, in your faith journey, you ran into some Christians who really knew what they were talking about. We want to know what we're talking about and be more effective in our witness. So what would that look like today? We want to be clear, but we want to be full of grace as well.
Yeah, and I think the part of it is to take a look at ourselves, too. Are we the church sometimes acts in a very post-truth way. In other words, our preferences seem to matter more than the facts and the truth sometimes. So Christians have to be very careful as to how we spread things, whether it's on social media or whatever. Do we actually investigate the articles that support our position and make our quote-unquote enemies look bad, or do we just forward them on without thinking about them? That's one way we can actually gain credibility, is by being careful and people with the truth. But the other way is to listen to the questions of culture. So when I think about the questions of culture today, oftentimes it's on meaning and purpose. One of the leading causes, in fact, the leading cause of death, I think between 15 and 28 years old, is suicide. And that's because people are finding less and less meaning. Isn't it ironic that the more and more people are given whatever they want in terms of their feelings and their preferences, the less meaning they actually have and the less hope they actually have? So that's one of the issues. But sexuality, science and faith, and this sort of seeming dichotomy between science and faith, that the more science we have, the less we need faith. One of the things Christians can do to equip themselves is to realize that faith is not wishful thinking. Faith is not believing something without evidence or despite the evidence. Faith is actually trust. That's what the Greek word means. It means to trust in the one who has given you enough evidence to trust him in the first place. So I, as a Christian, trust in what God will do in my life and in the future of this country based on what God has done in the past and given me the wonderful evidence for the resurrection and the validity of the Bible. And he has shown me through the creation itself that he has created this world through purpose.
Good insight from Abdu Murray today. We're talking about his book, Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. He's also written a Grand Central Question. I recommend that to you as well. And Abdu, I know that there are many of your forums. You actually put them on webcasts so people could find out more. I mean, tell us a little bit about what we might see if we were to get online and watch one of those live events.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we had a one at Yale, for example. Me and Robbie and I did one at Yale University, and we had 800 or so in attendance at a smaller chapel. We had, I think, 180-something thousand watching it live on YouTube, which is amazing. Contrast that with Michigan State University, where we had 9,500 who were actually live, as well as the thousands watching online. What you'll essentially see is about a two-hour program that includes a talk, sometimes just by one of us, but sometimes we tag team. Robbie and I tag team. He'll do 20 minutes, and I'll do 20 minutes. And we'll pick a topic of particular importance, like the post-truth culture. Can we know truth in a post-truth culture? Or where is God when it hurts? Or, you know, is Christianity bigoted? Something that's like a hot-button issue. And we'll give a short talk meant to stimulate questions. And then after the talk is done, we enter into a time of question and answer, and we'll usually have two microphones, and the students are invited to come up, and they ask their questions. No question is off limit, so long as it's actually a question and not a statement in the form of a question. We try to answer them as best we can. What you'll find, too, is that when we try to get to as many questions as possible, we often will give longer answers to the questions because the questions are deep and meaningful, and we don't want to give sound bites. We want to give as much deep meaning as we possibly can. So we often see those questions. And sometimes at our open forums, we actually invite questions from the audience, and whether it's on Facebook Live or on some other social media platform. If they type in their questions once in a while, we're actually able to take those as well, not just the live ones, but ones that are tweeted in, texted in, or other means as well. But what we hope to show you is that the Apostle Paul's statement that we are to answer each person, not each question, but each person, we're hoping to show that.
You show it well, and Abdu, it's been wonderful just to talk with you today. Boy, just a lot to review. I took a bunch of notes. I'm going to have to go back and review, and I hope people will check out rzim.org, or you can go to Abdu's website, abdumurray.com, and to find out about his books, speaking and writing. And I look forward to hearing more from you, Abdu, and blessings to you as you continue to share so effectively and communicate the good news of the gospel.
Thanks so much, Neil. You too, and thanks for having me on.
Abdu Murray joining us today on the Afternoon Show with Bill Arnold. That's what it is. I know where I am. Glad to have you listening in. I want to encourage you to be with us tomorrow as well. We have more great guests ready to go. And again, if you missed any part of today's show or other past shows, you find it all posted online, the Afternoon Show at MyFaithRadio.com. That's MyFaithRadio.com.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.